Hey, I'm Mike Stopforth, and this is The One-Eyed Man, a show where I talk to talented people doing meaningful work at the intersection of leadership, technology, and impact. Thanks to those of you who are return listeners, and of course, if you're here for the first time, a big warm welcome. My guest on this week's show is Dean Olshig. I met Dean on Twitter in the early days of social media, where we'd share notes on advertising and rugby and cricket and just about any other topic both of us cared about, which we inevitably landed up arguing about as well. Dean is a pure ad man and the founder of Halo Advertising. Halo has built an excellent reputation over the last decade and has done extraordinarily well in recent years with some truly standout and award-winning above-the-line creative work. In this episode, we discuss why creativity matters more now than ever and how advertising agencies like the ones we work in can assist clients better in producing brave and hopefully meaningful work. We also discuss the problems with purpose-based marketing, and Halo's exciting upcoming conference called Conspicuous, where none other than Mark Ritson will be a keynote speaker. Enjoy the conversation. I feel like your current Nando's snack and our Nando's Kasani experience is a metaphor for branding, actually, because happiness equals expectation minus reality, right? Once you've had the perfect burger,
The perfect Nando's burger on a boys fishing tour.
The perfect chicken burger.
That might have been the worst chicken burger we ever had, but the situation might have lent itself to us believing it was the best.
Well, there we go. Maybe we can extrapolate that into another analogy. But Dean, thank you for taking time to chat today. I think we'll probably cover a number of different topics. And so I want the conversation to be as free-flowing as possible. But I'd love to start with this really exciting announcement of yours, and that's Conspicuous, which is this clandestine conference that I'm very chuffed to have cracked a nod to, but is really a marketing conference with a distinct difference. Do you want to talk a little bit about the start of that idea and where it came from and how it all came together?
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, so about a year ago, we did what we've always tried to do for clients, which is try to narrow down a positioning for our clients. I think it's the first place any great brand needs to start from to be able to market itself successfully. And in our own positioning, we came up with this idea of conspicuous, and this idea that we believe creativity is this ultimate tool that brands need to use to get attention and stand out and get noticed. And so we came up with our own positioning, which is making standout brands and brands stand out, and define ourselves as a conspicuously creative company. And really, we believe more brands need to try stand out. If you actively begin your marketing efforts with that at the heart of what you're trying to achieve, I think you will ultimately create better work, because not every idea you look at is necessarily going to stand out in a crowded place of advertising and media. To double down on that, we decided to turn Conspicuous into a bigger asset than just a positioning for our agency. So we've created a property called Conspicuous, which is essentially going to be this event. It's going to kickstart a platform of which we're going to communicate a lot of thought leadership of ways in which brands can and should stand out. It's going to be an ongoing content series and newsletter going forward. And we're going to get multiple guests and influencers on the topic to kind of contribute towards that. So the event was really a starting point for us to bring together like-minded individuals, marketers who we think have the ambition to create standout brands, as well as speakers from local and abroad who can talk on the subject. So the first question we asked ourselves was, who do we think is the number one voice on the topic? And I've been following Mark Ritson for quite a few years. He's the leading journalist at Marketing Week, and he's a marketing professor. He's got a PhD in marketing. He was the global CMO of LVMH at one point. He's taught the marketing subject in the MBA at MIT. So he is a voice, a very good expert voice on the subject of marketing and marketing effectiveness. Mm. And he will back me in this, so I'm happy to say it, but creativity is one of the main levers that any marketer can pull to create a standout brand, to create effective communication, and leverage off what needs to be, as I said, as the start of this, to leverage off a strong positioning for the brand to achieve marketing effectiveness. So Mark's coming. We originally had Ahmed Tilly, who I've always been a huge fan of. He created some amazing standout work at Black River for Nando's, for First Woman, I think Ahmed's great skill is has always been selling creative ideas into organizations, which I think is a skill on its own. And then we've got a guy, quite an unknown guest, but by no means not a great guest, is Nick Asprey, who's a copywriter from the UK. He's writing a book on the perils of purpose and how purpose is actually not the silver bullet people think it is to achieve any kind of marketing effectiveness. We've then got Adam Morgan, who's a recent addition to the cast, who wrote the book Eating the Big Fish, which is basically the subject matter of challenger brands and how brands can adopt challenger thinking. Even the market leaders actually should adopt challenger thinking to really kind of stand out and use creativity as a tool to fight against maybe potentially smaller budgets if they don't have necessarily the resources of the bigger market leaders. We've got AB Mokgosuwane from Investec, who comes from a really interesting background of being agency first and then client second. And so he was at Ogilvy and then Vodacom and then Investec and can speak from both those points of view. And then Heidi Brouwer, who's just recently left as CMO of Hollard and a great friend. And so Heidi's going to be discussing just the merits of relationships for creating great work. The great insight there is great work doesn't create great relationships. Great relationships create great work. And that's, I mean, we could have a whole topic on pitching, but it's my big gripe with creative pitches is that they're all about work, not about relationships. And if we put relationships at the center of pitching, the whole pitch process would be vastly different.
Yeah, a lot to unpack there, obviously, because you've got this multitude of great speakers. You've got a fairly broad range of topics. And I've, for better or worse, had the opportunity to speak at a lot of marketing conferences. And you'll know generally they look and feel very much the same. The only thing that really changes is the flavor of endearments that gets put on your table. But generally speaking, same speakers, rinse and repeat. And you know, I'm guilty of that as well. And it is very difficult to stand out in that mix. And in a way, it feels like marketing conferences, certainly locally, are this kind of microcosm of what's happened in branding and creativity, where it's very much kind of rinse and repeat. Everybody seems afraid to do something significant, meaningful, daring, interesting. And essentially, it's kind of a copy paste, race to the bottom in differentiation. And I guess what I want to hear from you is why do you think that's happened? Is that because there's this sudden plethora of digital channels to choose from? And so we're not limited, or sometimes limitation is good and strict parameters are good. They produce better creativity. But what happened to creativity? Why have we stopped being brave?
Well, Mike, that's the million-dollar question, isn't
How much
it?
time do you
Yeah, how much
have?
time do you have? Funny enough, we spoke off air about the article I wrote for Marklibs last month, and my next one is about this exact reason. And I'm trying to. It's easy to try criticize the other side of the fence at the as the instigator for the death of creativity, but I don't think that that's the case. I think it's easy to revert into either two schools of thought. The one is what works. So we just do what worked once before, and so we end up in the sea of sameness, which is the truth for with the truth for any brand really, and marketing conferences, as you quite rightly pointed out. Or alternatively, there's this, well, they're the leader, so they must be right, so we're going to do what they're doing attitude. So inevitably you get a market leader who does X, and then everyone else in that industry copies them or tries to be like them. So
Copycat
does
syndrome,
so they do, yeah, exactly, the copycat syndrome. But I think that there's a deeper reason for that. I think we live in obviously a world of cancel culture, and so there's a fear of being cancelled constantly, and no brand manager wants to be the next Pepsi brand manager or Bud Light brand manager who makes that fatal mistake and wipes $20 billion off the balance sheet. So I think that's the easy answer, is to say cancel culture. But as a when I spoke about Ahmed earlier, when Ahmed was at Black River, I remember them doing the Nando's Robert Mugabe ad, and they released that ad on a Friday because the ASA was closed over the weekend, and they knew that someone was going to complain and was going to get pulled. but they gave it 3 days to kind of say, get as many people to see it before viral video was a thing. And it went from Friday to Monday, and a lot of everyone saw it, and everyone knows about that ad. And it was one of the most famous ads, and a really, really brave piece of work. No one does that. No one even does that anymore. No one puts an ad out on a Friday at risk of being pulled by Monday and trying to go behind ASA's back, because they're more worried about being cancelled on social media than they are worried about being pulled by ASA. Like, it doesn't even get, nothing is even brave enough to even consider ASA pulling it anymore, which is such a sorry place. And hopefully we will test that theory in the next few months. But then there's other reasons. I heard the editor of Contagious magazine say, in life, we know that drinking's bad for us, exercising is good, sleeping 8 hours a night is good, and eating salads are really good. But we don't necessarily do that, because doing that is really hard. And I think that the lesson to be learned there is, like, buying creative work is really hard. And buying creative work is hard because we got more decision makers at the end of the day. We've got a much more conservative process to approve work. There's much more than just a marketing person on the other side of we have our clients who we present work to, but they're not ultimately the decision maker. They've got an entire political network that they have to sell this thing to. And as soon as two people create an argument about something and they disagree about it, then, well, that immediately becomes a potential symptom of what the ad could do in social media or in the public's domain. And so they're like, oh, well, we don't want that to happen, so we'll pull that. We don't want debates about our work, so we'll pull that. And then I think agencies are to blame in that they, I don't think agencies are good at pushing back. I think because the relationships are so
imbalanced.
No, they're hanging by a thread so often. So they don't want to upset anybody. So they just go with the flow, and they just let clients creatively direct them. And they just go with what they want. They believe that there's this idea that quantity trumps quality at the moment. So when people present ideas, they don't present one idea anymore with conviction. They present three ideas. And inevitably, if you present three ideas, the client is going to pick, probably going to pick the safest one or the one in the middle. And that's never going to be the brave one, because the brave one is difficult. And then the work is quantity over quality. People are trying to create just, a piece of content every day, or it's all about how much can we produce out there. And I think that is so counterproductive, because it's counterproductive. It's counterintuitive and counterproductive at the same time. But it's so counterproductive.
Brave idea there, Dean.
Thank you. It's so counterproductive because great work takes time as well. And so by trying to produce a volume of work, you're never going to produce anything truly brave or great. So you're going to just produce a lot of the same stuff. And then the last answer to that question is really this proliferation of how easy it is to produce stuff, specifically, like, if you look at how easy it is to make work using AI. But that is just that's an aggregator of stuff, right? And so the ideas are getting aggregated, the production is getting aggregated, how they feel is being aggregated, and inevitably all the stuff ends up looking the same anyway. So everything, like, we're in a world where creating something that feels the same, we're a bias towards that rather than, so it's becoming more and more difficult to produce something that stands out. And so people who want to create work that stands out have to try that much harder to do it.
Yeah, at the risk of sounding like an increasingly irrelevant middle-aged white man, there's an analogy to be drawn between what's happened in advertising and what's happened in music, right?
And film.
And yeah, so one of the wonderful things about kind of social media and the digital world is how easy it has become to create music and build a network and become essentially a star without navigating the traditional gatekeepers of influence and publishing and so on. And there are just a multitude of wonderful success stories. But it also means this, like, proliferation of average as well, like a proliferation of kind of mediocre. And like, I think a narrow minded way of looking at that universe is going, they don't make it like they used to, which I actually don't think is true. I think there is truly remarkable music out there, just like I think there is a lot of truly remarkable work. It's just really hard for it to stand out anymore or even to find it, because that kind of the traditional barriers that aren't there allow for this kind of the surfacing of everything that isn't important or interesting. And so it just kind of gets buried amongst all of that and it becomes increasingly hard. So I think there are wonderful, emergent, interesting, brave agencies out there and clients that are doing challenging and exciting work. I don't think it's the majority. I think it's the rare minority, and you guys certainly fall into that bracket. But it's almost like because everything is easy, anything that is special becomes so much harder to, number one, discover, but number two, kind of be recognized for its remarkableness.
Remarkability, I think is the word. We really are Monday afternoon word salads here.
It's very late on a Monday afternoon.
I know. For anyone, this is 4:30 on a Monday, so you got to understand the brain capacity of both of us, right? I think movies is another good example of that. In a different way, though, a good analogy, because just how many movies right now are sequels or the like, you know, remakes of something else, and there's just so few really, really great original films right now because the cost to produce them is too high and far outweighs the risk. And and so it's easier to rather go make the 77th Marvel film because they know that there's an audience waiting to see it. And that's so commercial. Mm-hmm. So creativity has been replaced by commercialism in that front. And you see that with ads. Like how many ads can you think of where you've had someone taste the product or drink the product or experience the product and then break out in a dance because that's the feeling the product gives them. You know, it's like it's the tried old formula of advertising, and it's just every 2 or 3 months there's a new version of that kind of comes out, like these tried and tested formulas become out. And yes, you're 100% right, there's definitely agencies that stand out. You know, globally there's still the agencies like Droga5 or Martin Agency or BBH London or Adam and Eve, and then there's and then obviously recently there's Uncommon and Gut, which are just tremendous agencies, independent agency stories, but they've recently sold. Droga5's been around for 15 years doing this kind of stuff, which is amazing. But they're the exception of the rule. And
sure.
You know, the latest IPA and WRC, the WOC study, is that only 9% of all advertising is noticed and remembered. And that means 91% of all work that gets put out there is completely benign, vanilla, ticking boxes, you know, doing the bare minimum. But you know what it's not doing is causing offense, getting someone fired,
sure.
and making the news for the wrong reasons. And that's it's also easier to do the former rather than the latter. And I think that matters. And yeah, I think like I had a look at TikTok the other day. I was trying to research how many videos get uploaded to TikTok every day. And I can't remember the number. It's like 80 million or something per day. And if you think of how many of those TikTok videos go viral, you start to understand how the odds are against you to create some kind of piece of work that's going to connect and stand out. And often you'll have like two very similar pieces of work, two very similar TikTok videos that go out, and for some reason the one went famous and the other one didn't. And a lot of that
real rhyme.
Yeah. A lot of that is really difficult to put your finger on what that reason is. And I think like part of the skill of like that just shows that that to create something that's going to stand out, you there's a great saying by Jason Bagley, who was the creative director at Whedon and Kennedy in Portland, who did a lot of the Old Spice work. And he said, you have to push ideas to the edge of madness. There's always going to be a client. There's always going to be a client who's going to pull you back from the edge. But our job as agency is to push the ideas to the edge of madness and then wait for someone else to rein you in. But if your ideas are not that far, if you haven't pushed them that far, the chance of you standing out and getting noticed is very slim.
So it segues, I think, into one of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about. And that's because we're saying that like bravery is hard and it costs a lot and there's also risk to it. And I guess one of the responses that a lot of CMOs and marketing directors would say to us is, but it is brave to take a stand. It's brave to, you know, in a politically charged or kind of socially charged context, saying that you care about the environment or doing something that is expressly in the interest of the betterment of the greater good, or make this is the brave stance. And so you can understand the thinking behind why a lot of brands would take a an attempt at least to align themselves with purpose and to align themselves with some social cause or impactful need. Because it also seems like low-hanging fruit, right? Because they, you know, this is the counterbalance to the cancel culture thing. Is that, man, if you get it right and you say something that, you know, politically everybody is on board with, wow, like this is a really great way to earn some creative kudos really fast. But we, you know, you've thought a lot about the perils of purpose. I think to steal Nick's book title and especially, and I would extend that, because obviously I mean I studied impact-led entrepreneurship and I've studied purposeful marketing and I care deeply about these topics and I think great work can be done here, but this also kind of sort of it ties in very closely with my favorite soapbox, which is the whole narrowing the gap between what you promise and what you deliver, right? And it's one thing getting marketers to create this incredible promise on behalf of your brand. But if you deliver something completely different in actuality, it's worse than not making the promise in the first place. So what is your response to people that say, but taking a stand socially is brave?
It depends what you're trying to achieve. So firstly, I think the reason why brands get canceled is not because that they're brave. I think the reason why brands get canceled is because they're inauthentic. So brands that try to do something that doesn't authentically align to who they are is when a brand has a higher propensity to be canceled. So
yeah,
Pepsi proposing that a Pepsi is going to create dialogue between protesters and the police, or Bud Light suddenly trying to align itself to the trans community. Like those are totally inauthentic positions for those brands to play in. And hence,
well, I think the Bud Light example, sorry to interrupt you, but is the quintessential example of how frivolous that attempt was, or how shallow it was, because the counterbalance was like, oh, okay, we've lost ground with an audience that typically connected with us. So instead of aligning with the trans agenda, how about we sponsor UFC for a while, which is such an outrageous like pendulum swing in the other direction, which just shows the level of commitment to either whether you're talking about the traditional UFC audience, the traditional trans ally, like it's just a complete lack of deliberate commitment.
Or authenticity, right? It's a lack of authenticity. And it's trying to appease all audiences at once because and that only happens when you don't have a clear positioning. If you are, because strategy and positioning for me is about, and this is actually, I'm starting seeing this as a Mark Ritson quote, but strategy is about sacrifice. So strategy is about understanding what you say no to. And if you're completely bold in your positioning and your strategy, you know exactly what to say no to. And that's how you, over time, you build authenticity and resonance with your audience. The purpose thing is obviously a hot topic. I think first and foremost, brands or businesses, let me say businesses, not brands, businesses that are built off some kind of social purpose have every right to support that social purpose. Tony Schiaccoloni in the UK started because there's still too many examples of slavery in the cocoa process. And so that they've tried to create a chocolate brand that is zero slavery. And so they have alignment to that, right? Patagonia since day one has been about the environment and so that purpose is aligned to their business. It's not a purpose that has been dreamt up in a marketing boardroom that has been plastered on top of their brand in an attempt to garner favor.
When things got tough.
when things got well, the whole reason, purpose, the purpose movement arose was off the back of the 2008 recession, and businesses were corporate sentiment was at an all time low, and so people started to align themselves with social purpose to try garner favor with an audience that didn't hold them in high regard, and it's just snowballed from there. It's become prevalent in almost every marketing rule book in the world, and it's ridiculous because, you know, there's so many reasons why purpose doesn't work. Firstly, there's almost no examples in any effectiveness papers that proves purpose is actually a marketing effective tool. It's definitely a tool to look like you're doing good, but it's definitely not a tool that will sell you product, which is what ultimately marketing should be doing. Nick's book is actually titled The Road to Hell. The Road to Hell is Paved with Good Intentions. If you use social impact as your path to marketing or as your strategy, what is your return metric? What do you measure there? Like, do you measure how many products you sold? Because then you don't care about the purpose. Or do you measure how much social impact did I do? Because then it's not a commercial marketing objective that you're measuring it against. So what are you measuring it against? And my argument against so much of the work that I see that is social purpose, so many of those brands like are guilty of the exact opposite thing they put out there in the background, and almost none of them are innocent in that. And then to that point, you see the social impact work that they do, and they're not making any change. They're just advertising a problem. They're talking about, oh, that's really bad, and I'm not going to get into detail, and I'm not going to use
building awareness.
They're building awareness about a problem. They're building awareness about the thing that someone should be fixing. And now, if they're suddenly taking ownership of a problem, whether it's GBV or sustainability or the environment, they're pulling attention away from the people who are actually trying to do something about it. So the NGOs that are working for those types of problems that are being solved, they should really have the monopoly on those things. And by all means, like brands can contribute towards them. That's called CSI. But we used to contribute towards them and not talk about them. Now everyone wants to contribute to them, but make it into an advertising campaign. And I think that's where, for me, it's completely disingenuous.
Yeah, so rather take the traditional philanthropic route and channel spend wisely through, you know, kind of an analysis, and then through those channels like CSR, which were established for that cause. I suppose there's a danger there because CSI traditionally also became a little bit of like a kind of guilt tithe, where there was like just money sort of being siphoned off to a portion of the organization that had absolutely no intention of using it meaningfully. And there was, you know, William McCaskill is credited for a movement called, I've forgotten the name of his book. But their entire movement is built around measuring impact and understanding how raw dollars translate to, you know, kind of meaningful change on the ground. Effective altruism, that's what it's called. Sorry, that was the book and the movement behind it. Sam Harris speaks about it quite a lot. So like if you apply that kind of formula to the CSR model, then yes, sure. But I suppose all of this is kind of representative of a broad truth, and that's that businesses will do whatever they can to plaster up the parts of their story that are incongruent or inconsistent with whatever it is that they're pretending to be, either to their own staff or to the audience that's buying products from them. And I suppose the other challenge is that, you know, you get big enough, you know, if, as an organization, you have long enough tendrils, it's almost impossible to absolve yourself of any negative impacts or negative externalities. You know, so part of that, I think, is just kind of rather understanding and owning up to those and working to resolve them rather than, you know, trying to put lipstick on a pig.
Yeah, but also, like, I feel that that's the easy way out. You know, if I don't have a strong positioning, if I don't have a story to tell that's going to make my brand stand out in a crowded industry, then the easy way out is to attach myself to some kind of social purpose. And it's just not going to be as effective as doing something which is entertaining or doing something that is insightful or doing something that resonates with an audience or creating a product that your audience actually needs or loves or wants. And those things are all really difficult to do. And that's why, as I said, 9%, only 9% of the work that's in the market actually does that. So to create social purpose around your brand or to try align your brand to some kind of social cause it's the easy way out. It's the low hanging fruit, as you said, but it either advertises the problem. I don't know why. I know why people do it because it's the easy way out. It's like sitting in front of the couch instead of going for a run. Like that's what aligning to social purpose is. But there's a great story that Nick tells, is that the ultimate, and I've touched on this in the past before, you know, the upside of capitalism really is that you get to create, if you do a great marketing job, that the purpose of that is actually to create more jobs and to put more kids in school and to, you know, if you can give a job to the person who's going to come and open your store in the morning, who's going to then put her daughter into education through education, why is that not a good purpose to back? But for some reason, businesses making money is frowned upon. You know, commercialism and capitalism is obviously they're dirty words. But at the end of the day, like that's what marketing exists for. It doesn't exist to try to save the world. Like that's what NGOs are for. If you're not an NGO, then you're a for-profit organization, and therefore you should be in the business of making profits. And if you're a good business, then you should be using your profit wisely and doing it in ways that look after your people. And if your people want to then support causes and stuff, then by all means, let them do that.
So at the risk of going further down that philosophical road, I wanted to kind of test your thinking on something that's sort of aligned to that, but like a big bugbear in my life. And again, having, at least in my professional life, having had the privilege of working with several large financial services brands and telco brands that find themselves in highly competitive, very saturated markets where there's a sense that sometimes the products that they sell, the offerings or services that populate their suite are so like commoditized that really the only differentiator is price, or you're trying to snatch up somebody who got bad service from somebody else. And essentially we're just transporting the same customer base back and forth between almost identical products. And that's the word, I'm painting the worst possible picture of this, but
you know,
the reason I speak about that is that I think one of the traps of traditional marketing and advertising agencies is that we are so relentlessly focused on acquisition, on winning new business, that we've forgotten that there's a role for marketing to play in acknowledging and engaging and rewarding those customers that have been loyal and connected and faithful and kind of consistent in their and there's a real, I mean, this is a bizarre conundrum, because you could argue that the people that we're fighting for grabbing the business of, right, like the people that change banks or change telcos the most are also probably the least loyal, interested, faithful, committed, deliberate customers. So there's this real kind of like irony in it. So my question is, how do you think about the role of marketing and specifically advertising and maybe even branding in retention rather than, I mean, you and I have even experimented with the idea of a limited subscription banking model, right? The bank that only has 50,000 customers and everybody else is on a waiting list.
Still think it's a good idea.
How do you think about that? It's a great idea. Pitch it to Chris Wood, I think.
Yeah, let's go. Chris, if you ever hear this, please come talk to us. We would like to start a new bank. Les Burnett and Peter Field wrote a book 10 years ago called The Long and the Short of It. And it's probably weirdly, but like Fight Club, like it did nothing at box office, but it's over time, it's become more and more valuable. And people are starting.
Long tail of interest, yeah.
Yeah. People are now starting to realize the value of it. And the long and the short of it is to say that brands that just focus on acquisition or focus on the short term, they're winning clients as often as they're losing clients. And as soon as they stop spending on acquisition, they're going to just start going into downward spirals. They always have to spend money to keep that cycle going. The long of it is brand. The long of it is building a brand that resonates with people, that has an emotional connection to people. And obviously what building a long-term brand is going to do is it's going to have short-term effects and it's going to have long-term effects. And the long-term effects, which people undervalue quite heavily, is the role of retention. People want to be with brands that they love or like, even or in some regards they regard as the best of a bad bunch. And I think, especially today, it's so easy to switch, and we've got so much choice that I would, as a consumer, I'd probably try to give my money to those brands that I feel are making efforts or doing some work that I'm going to value. And, you know, and as an example, as I'm going to try to give you two positive examples to show this point. Mm. But the one example was F&B. I think F&B's brand in the late 2000s, early 2010s was phenomenal. I think the how can we help you, the innovation, the first brand that would fund your iPad, that did like really, really proper internet banking. Like, they were built around innovation. And I associated myself with them. I'd been a customer of there for 30 years. And I was never leaving F&B. They probably didn't realize it at the time, but the work that they were doing on their brand at the time was instrumental in making me completely satisfied as a customer of theirs, to never even consider leaving. The other brand another example of brand work that I still to this day absolutely love is the VW brand. And I think that the work that the VW guys did in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and then one of my favorite ads was the Arno Carstens Touareg ad, which is probably from about it's probably from about 2005-ish, so maybe 20 years ago. And I think that the work that brand did in my upbringing has made me a fan of VW for life, way more deeply entrenched in my soul and my being and my brain than anything any acquisition piece could do right today from any of the other car brands, right? And I think that
this is so like, weird. There's bubbles appearing on my screen.
I think they're balloons.
Ian and I are trying to figure out where the balloons come from.
I think they're balloons.
Sorry to derail your thought there. We've spoken about that, right?
Well, I'm on my fifth VW now, and yes, obviously the product is exceptional, and there's a lot going for it that I agree with. But I think my affinity comes from brand work that was done
something deeper.
20 to 30 years ago, right? And that just shows the long tail of brand, both on acquisition and retention.
I just want to sidebar there quickly, because, you know, you spoke about Hades' topic at the conference, which is going to be great relationships, great brands. And I know we can't necessarily paint the entire VW relationship, but there's something to be said, certainly locally. Big shout out to our friend Alex Goldberg and Bridget and the team for the relationship that consistently produces the kind of work that is remarkable, right? And like you said, that it doesn't happen because of the great work. It happens because of the relationship and the trust and the hard yards that have been put down over literally decades. And that definitely stands out as an abnormal type of brand agency engagement.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and I'm standing to be corrected, I think that the Ogilvy VW relationship is 30 years plus in South Africa.
Yeah.
I know personally that, you know, Alex and Bridget's relationship is exceptional, and together they create great work, most of which, you know, everyone has kind of seen. And most recently they did the Blind Spot campaign, which is exceptional and you know, won everything recently. Yeah. And so, yeah, that relationship does definitely lead towards that process. And what relationships do is that they, especially long term relationships, is they create longevity. They create longevity in trust, but they also create consistency and consistency and understanding. So, you know, I've mentioned positioning. Mm. I wrote a piece recently around the power of positioning, patience, and have a break, have a Kit Kat was the example I used, which is 57 years old right now. And, you know, and they've gone through so many changes over those 57 years, the biggest of which was when Roundtrees was sold to Nestle in 1988. And obviously the temptation then is like, it's probably going to be a whole new marketing team. It's going to be an entire new agency. And the temptation there is to go, oh, out of the old, in with the new, we're going to make change. Mm-hmm. But credit, because someone there went, hang on, no, like this thing is really good. It works. There's huge amounts of creativity and credit.
That's why we bought it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why we bought it. So let's, you know, don't fix what isn't broken. And we, marketers, agency people, we're obsessed with change. We're obsessed with new technology. We're obsessed with the latest trends. Like, just go into BizCom and Mark lives in January and February and just see how many trend forecasts are out. And we're obsessed with that kind of stuff. We're obsessed with the new technology. We're obsessed with what's AI going to do. And
a shiny new thing.
You know, we're obsessed about AI just as much as we obsessed about AR and VR and all these other things that were around in the last 10 years.
NFTs.
And yeah, exactly. And yet none of that stuff has changed the truth of great work, which is, and standout work, which is, it has to connect with the human being. Like, that's the truth. And to do that, you've got to have insights. You've got to have humor. You've got to have courage. You've got to have conviction, some bravery. And my favorite analogy on this is, like, you've got to entertain, like, and have fun with it. And if the consumer can see something and go, flip, they look like they had fun with that, then there's a high likelihood the consumer's going to have fun watching it, you know. But if you just shut that thing out in AI in 15 seconds, then no one's going to go, oh, wow, I really can appreciate the effort that went into making this, and therefore I'm going to give it my time of my day. I think that making things for people is just the truth, and you do that, you're going to stand out, and people are going to give you their attention if you give them something that they're going to enjoy consuming.
Which segues us really nicely back into a conversation about your conference.
Yep.
So it's different because, unfortunately, as many people who I'm sure are desperate to attend listening to the show and your wisdom on the topic, they can't just sign up and attend. It's invitation only. However, I did see that you guys are running a campaign where people could potentially one of two tickets. Is that correct?
If I can answer that in a few stages. Firstly, like, one of the reasons why we really want to make it different is because I want to put people in an environment where they enjoying learning and listening and debating. And so we're actually hosting the event at a client of ours, which is Hart Cabrera. We're hosting it in their cellar in Franschhoek, which I think is immediately makes it a completely different experience to going to a convention center. And yeah, so unfortunately the venue is limited to only seat 60 people. So that's how many people we can allow through the door. So we've had to unfortunately be quite picky on who we let in. But because of, I think that the people that are coming, and we're super excited to see what they have to say. And obviously some of them are, I've spoken to all of them and know exactly what their topics are going to be about, because I want to make it sure it's 100% relevant. We're filming every single one of those talks, and we're going to release each one.
Awesome.
We're going to release each one soon after the event, by signing up. So the sign up, has the sign up plug, which is conspicuous.brandhalo.com .co.za. So that's conspicuous. It's a tough one to spell. We spelt it wrong in our showreel for about a good month before anyone picked it up. Luckily, the showreel wasn't live yet. And yeah, but so conspicuous.brandhalo.co.za. I'm hoping Mike will put the link in somewhere. And then we'll release all those videos. And as Mike said, we're going to still choose two people to join us from the signups. I just think that there's so many lessons that can be learned from these people, whether you see them at our conference, whether you watch our videos, or whether you just follow them. Adam Morgan has got this incredible podcast called The Cost of Dell. And him and Peter Field have recently concluded some research in the UK. So it's a UK specific study. And they recently concluded a study where they tried to calculate the cost of interesting work versus Dell work. And they believe that the cost, depending on industry, is roughly between 10 and 20 million pounds is the number you have to spend extra on Dell work to get the same effectiveness as interesting work. So I love that. Everyone keeps talking about how the returns on creativity, and it's very hard to quantify, but they've tried to quantify what happens if you don't be creative, or you don't make standout work, or you don't create interesting work. And so he's got a podcast called Make It Interesting by Adam Morgan. And he interviews people from... So
are you saying Dull or Dell?
It's a difficult word to pronounce. D-U-L-L. Dull.
It's not a difficult word to pronounce. It's literally a U. You just say Dull.
What am I saying?
Not Dell.
I think I...
You said Dell. Like, it's in the computers. I was like, what's wrong with Dell? Why are you picking on Dell? Like, Dell, it's not that bad.
Dull. Boring. The word is boring. Let's change the word to boring. Dell is a Dell word to pronounce. Yeah. I think it's my Durban accent coming through, Mike.
It might be. It might be. I'll clarify that in the show notes as well.
Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate it. It's now Monday, 5 o'clock. Yeah, so he's got a Make It Interesting podcast. He interviews people from very different walks of life. He interviews a science teacher. He interviews the lady who was the showrunner of the UK Apprentice. It's all these people whose their livelihood is dependent on how interesting they can make certain things and boring subject matter. And if they can do it, then anyone should be able to hold their agency accountable to make interesting work for brands.
Very cool. Great recommendation. And Jim, at the end there, that's all we have time for, unfortunately. Thanks, Dean.
Really appreciate you
making time on short notice. I'm sorry we couldn't do this in person. It would have been a lot more fun, but time is of the essence. I'm very excited about the conference. Thanks again for the opportunity to attend. And yeah, we'll certainly be sharing information with everybody who's listening about how they can find out more about Halo. But yeah, best place to find you guys. What's the URL? I know it's the conspicuous URL, but where do people find you on the internet?
Yeah, so I think I'm probably most active on LinkedIn. So Halo Advertising on LinkedIn or myself. We have a lot of fun on Instagram. If you want to go to Halo Advertising on Instagram, and then brandhalo.co.za to check out some of the work that we've created.
Sweet. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to the One-Eyed Man podcast. I'm Mike Stopforth, an entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker, deeply curious about discovering better ways to lead and better ways to live in an increasingly complex world. I find the best source of these ideas is the experience and wisdom of interesting people who are taking unconventional approaches to solving the world's most compelling problems. If you'd like to hear from someone I haven't yet spoken to, visit mikestopforth.com. Click on the podcast link and send through your suggestions. A big thanks to the Solid Gold Podcast Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa, for making this production possible. And remember, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man/person is king.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.